as you are in Warren, Michigan, working at the General Motors plant. Sean is UAW Local 160 member in Michigan. His recent piece for Labor Notes will link to, will Trump's tariffs be good for auto workers? Next up, the Supreme Court has paused a court-imposed order for the U.S. to bring home a Maryland father who was mistakenly flown, that admission from the Trump administration, to a supermax prison in El Salvador. We'll speak with the family's lawyer and go to San Salvador to look more closely at this notorious supermax prison that's jailing hundreds of immigrants and asylum seekers sent from the United States. Back in 30 seconds. Is coming by Wu Lai. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Supreme Court issued two rulings Monday related to the Trump administration expelling immigrants to a notorious supermax prison in El Salvador. In one case, the court ruled in a 5-4 decision to allow the Trump administration to resume, for now, its use of the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to send Venezuelan nationals to El Salvador. However, the justices ruled the targeted individuals are entitled to challenge their removal from the United States. But it's unclear what this means for the 238 Venezuelans who were sent to El Salvador last month in defiance of a judge's order and imprisoned at this notorious prison outside San Salvador. In a separate decision, Chief Justice John Roberts temporarily paused a lower court order that instructed the Trump administration to bring back a Maryland dad who'd been mistakenly sent to El Salvador. The Trump administration's acknowledged that Kilmer Abrego Garcia was removed from the U.S. in error on March 15th. But the administration claims they're now powerless to bring him back to his family, even though the Trump administration is paying El Salvador $6 million a year to imprison immigrants expelled from the United States. Abrego Garcia, who's from El Salvador, was granted protected legal status in the U.S. by an immigration court in 2019, prohibiting the federal government from sending him back to El Salvador after he fled gang violence there. On Sunday, federal judge Paula Chinas accused the Trump administration of committing a grievous error that shocks the conscience by seizing and expelling Abrego Garcia. She was the judge who'd ordered Abrego Garcia to be returned home by midnight Monday night. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has placed a senior immigration lawyer on indefinite leave after he acknowledged in court Friday that the Trump administration had made a mistake in sending Abrego Garcia back to El Salvador. On Friday, his wife, Jennifer, briefly spoke to reporters.
I want to say thank you to everyone that has helped us, that has supported us in fighting this. And we will continue fighting for Kilmer, for my husband. Thank you.
We're joined now by two guests. From San Salvador, Noah Bullock is with us, the executive director of Cristosal, a human rights group in Central America. His recent piece for Foreign Policy, The Horror Inside the Salvadoran Prisons Where Trump is Sending Migrants. And in Virginia, we're joined by Simon Sandoval Moschenberg, an immigration lawyer representing Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia and his family. Let's begin with Simon. If you could talk about the latest ruling and how it affects your client, how he was removed to El Salvador, how he's been imprisoned, and now the ruling of Chief Justice Roberts.
Sure. I mean, this case arose out of an accident, right? I mean, the government admits that they didn't have any legal basis whatsoever to deport him to El Salvador. That's not entirely out of the ordinary. You know, it happens from time to time. I've been practicing immigration law for nearly two decades. Erroneous deportations happen. But in every previous such case that I've handled, and I've spoken with several other immigration lawyers, you know, as soon as you bring this to their attention, they sort of, and convince them that they've made a mistake, they immediately set the wheels in motion to fix it, right? They bend over backwards. I've had plenty of clients return to the United States before. I've spoken with lawyers who've had clients removed to Iraq by accident, and, you know, we managed to get them back. What was different about this case is that we brought it to their attention, we filed a lawsuit, and there was just essentially no response whatsoever. And the posture of the administration has been, yeah, we made a mistake. No, we're not going to do anything whatsoever to fix it. And no court can order us to fix it. That's really what's remarkable about this case. And then they've dug in their heels at every step of the way, at the district court, at the Court of Appeals, and now the Supreme Court. I mean, it's ridiculous that this case is at the Supreme Court at all. The government is really the ones who've chosen to make a big national issue out of this particular case, which really should have just been resolved very quickly and quietly.
But Simon, when you say that these kinds of errors in deportations sometimes occur, the judge in this particular case, the federal district judge in Maryland, stated that the only evidence against your client consisted, quote, of nothing more than his Chicago Bulls hat and hoodie and a vague, uncorroborated allegation from a confidential informant claiming he belonged to MS-13's Western clique, a place he's never lived. This seems to go a little bit beyond just an error. What about this whole issue of how the government is identifying supposed potential not only criminal aliens, but people that are destabilizing the country.
Right. That all actually dates back to 2019. None of that is even contemporary, right? He was first arrested by ICE in 2019 when he was working as a day laborer in front of a Home Depot. There was this anonymous tip, this confidential informant, combined with the fact that he was wearing a Chicago Bulls hat, that as far as ICE was concerned, was, you know, more than enough to label him a gang member. When he was first detained by ICE, he had a preliminary hearing, and the immigration judge essentially said, well, I don't know what's going on. We've got this confidential tip. I can't be satisfied. I don't know what's going on, so I'm going to deny his release. So the judge essentially ordered that he continued to be detained during his immigration proceedings. But then he had a trial, right? And he won his trial. The judge ordered him relief from removal, ordered that he could not be deported to El Salvador, granted him withholding of removal. And the government, the Trump administration at the time, didn't even bother to appeal, right? They just sort of said, oh, all right, that's fine. They released him from detention and they gave him a work permit. And he's been working, which he's renewed ever since. And he's been working legally now as a sheet metal worker apprentice on a legal work permit ever since. So to the extent that they've got these allegations against him, they're not even sort of contemporary allegations. They're 6 years old.
And in terms of this whole issue of the government claiming that it can't, it has no ability to bring him back.
Yeah.
Talk about that. And also, the government has a contract with the government of El Salvador to hold these deportees.
Right. I mean, the government's sort of main defense here is in their pleadings, in the case, leaving aside their rhetoric from the from the White House press secretary, the government's main defense is not that he's supposedly an MS-13 member. It's this sort of impossibility defense. It would be impossible, right? How could we possibly do it? They've provided no evidence to that effect, right? And we provided fairly significant evidence that there is an agreement between the United States and El Salvador vis-a-vis this prison. We've got the president of El Salvador, Bukele, tweeting that he's receiving $6 million from the United States to house United States detainees in this prison. Marco Rubio, in response to that tweet, tweeting, thank you, President Bukele. We've got the fact that after our case was filed, right, after we had a preliminary scheduling conference with the judge, so they were already on notice of what they had done to Mr. Abrego Garcia, They put Kristi Noem within the walls of that prison, got her out again on a same day basis. And plenty of other evidence, which, you know, is certainly circumstantial evidence, but a mountain of circumstantial evidence adds up, especially when faced with no contrary evidence from the government. And the district judge in Maryland found, and then the Court of Appeals in Richmond agreed, that there's enough evidence to show that we have an agreement with the government of El Salvador, and that pursuant to that agreement, we could request them back.
I want to bring Noah Bullock into this conversation. He's in San Salvador, not that far from the prison where migrants, where asylum seekers are being sent from the United States, this SECOT prison. For the first time, Noah, it must be something for you to see this kind of focus from the United States on what you've been noting and other human rights groups for quite some time. The fact is, hundreds of Salvadoran prisoners, is this right, have died in El Salvador's prisons, the same prison system that the U.S. is paying millions of dollars to the president, who has declared a state of exception in your country. Explain what that is and what we should know about these prisons.
Sure. And thank you for the invitation, Amy. The state of exception, in some ways, is similar to the Alien Enemies Act in the United States, only that it's applied to Salvadoran citizens. It's an emergency declaration that restricts due process rights, and has been in place for 3 years. It was an emergency decree that was originally put in place to combat gang violence, but in over the course of 3 years, 85,000 Salvadorans have been detained under this decree. And in our investigation of cases, the overwhelming majority of those detentions have been illegal. People detained without evidence, without prior investigations or even judicial warrants, purely on the discretion of the police officers and soldiers that are rounding them up. And once they're in prison, they're able to be held for up to 3 years now without going to trial, without formally being accused of a crime. And in prison, they're cut off from communication from their families. They don't have access to defense attorneys. These conditions constitute, under international law, forced disappearances. And inside the prisons, we've been able to document systematic torture, physical abuse, but also denial of access to food, water, clothing, healthcare, hygiene. Much has been made of SECOT, the mega prison that was built during the state of exception. It's a very new prison. But the majority of the 85,000 people who have been detained are being held in older maximum security prisons. And the conditions of physical abuse combined with intentional denial of access of basic necessities, according to our research, has produced the deaths of at least 368 people. But the testimonial evidence of prisoners or former prisoners is that that number is likely much higher. So while the focus of the media attention and even the government's own propaganda has been on SECOT, this new prison, the majority of the people detained in the state of exception are in other prisons where conditions are likely much worse.
And Noah, could you talk about there have been more than 7,000 petitions of habeas corpus submitted to the Salvadoran Supreme Court? How have the courts handled these petitions so far?
Yeah, that's another important parallel to draw here with the situation in the United States. When the president's party won a supermajority in the legislature, the very first night, the very first legislative session, they overthrew the constitutional court here, which is the highest court in the land. And they installed new magistrates that would be loyal to the president. After that, they purged about a third of the judges in the lower courts and put the rest of them basically on notice that they could be removed at the discretion of the new Supreme Court. So there's a lack of judicial independence. And that's what we've seen. You mentioned the number. We estimate that about 7,200 habeas corpus claims have been made to the Constitutional Court during the state of exception, and less than 1% of those have been resolved by the court. meaning that effectively the constitutional right to habeas corpus has been denied systematically to Salvadorans. We also have documented how, in the state of exception, they've created new courts, specific tribunals, with judges whose identities are secret. So these are ad hoc secret tribunals that were created specifically to convict people detained in the state of exception. And reforms to the penal code will allow the Attorney General in El Salvador, who was also installed through a legislative coup in that same night, to prosecute the people in groups of 900. They've even said publicly up to 2,000. The Salvadoran government has said specifically that they're not intending even to try these people individually, rather in groups. And when we've looked at cases and our lawyers who have tried to exercise the defense of people who have been detained with chronic illnesses, physical handicaps, and even pregnant women, the accused are unable to exercise even the most minimal defense in these tribunals, and they're accused without any individual evidence brought against them. That reminds me a little bit of the case of Kilmer, right? That there's no evidence been brought against him other than somebody said he's in a gang.
I want to end with Simon in Virginia. What happens next with Kilmer Armando Obrego Garcia? You have the Chief Justice pausing the timeline. The rule was last night by midnight he had to be brought back. So what happens now? This goes to the full Supreme Court?
Yeah, the Chief Justice entered a brief administrative stay just so that the Supreme Court could, you know, essentially get its work done, right? The Supreme Court didn't even get the case till 2 o'clock on Monday. The deadline was midnight at the 5-hour flight. We have every confidence that the Supreme Court is going to work on this and issue a ruling very quickly. But yes, it will go to all 9 justices of the Supreme Court. I expect and hope that they will rule in our client's favor and that they'll do so as quickly as possible this week. They'll set a new deadline, right? They'll give the government however many hours or however many days to comply. And then we expect the government to start working in good faith to actually do that. There's been not one iota of good faith so far in this case. They haven't reached out to us at all. They clearly didn't make any steps to start complying with the judge's order, you know, in case their legal strategy of appeals didn't work. It's time for them to actually start doing the right thing here.
Simon Sandoval-Moschenberg, we thank you so much for being with us. Immigration lawyer representing Kilmer Armando Obrego Garcia, who is now imprisoned in the notorious SECA, the supermax outside of San Salvador. And Noah Bullock, executive director of CristaSal, a human rights group in Central America, speaking to us from San Salvador. We'll link to your piece, The Horror Inside the Salvadoran Prisons Where Trump is Sending Migrants. Next up, Black Americans Are Not Surprised, writes Ford and Professor Christina Greer. Stay with us.
No more. No more.
Block for me, sweet honey in the rock. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The National Park Service Monday appeared to have restored its original webpage on the history of the Underground Railroad following a backlash over its deletion of a prominent image of abolitionist Harriet Tubman, as well as edits to the text that minimized the horrors of slavery, instead talking about white-black cooperation. A Washington Post investigation published Sunday found in the weeks following Trump's inauguration, Tubman's photograph had been removed and replaced with images of Postal Service stamps that highlighted this black-white cooperation. Late last month, President Trump issued an executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, which claims the Smithsonian's museums have come under, quote, the influence of a divisive race-centered ideology, unquote. The order singles out the National Museum of African American History history and culture inaugurated by President Obama in 2016. On Friday, Kevin Young, the director of the museum since 2021, resigned. Our next guest argues nothing about these efforts to whitewash American history, nor the Trump administration's expanding crackdown on dissent and immigration, should be surprising to Americans. Fordham University professor Christina Greer's latest op-ed for The New York Times is headlined, Black Americans Are Not Surprised. She writes, quote, it's frightening and disappointing, but not surprising if one knows anything about the Black experience in America, unquote. Christina Greer, thank you so much for being with us. You wrote the book, How to Build a Democracy, from Fannie Lou Hamer and Barbara Jordan to Stacey Abrams, as well as the book Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you take it from the title, from there? Black Americans are not surprised.
Thanks, Amy. Well, you know, there's just been so much hand-wringing about how could this be happening? What's going on? This isn't the country I know. And so many Black Americans are like, this is absolutely the country we know. This is a country that's made a lot of progress over the decades, the centuries. But there's always progress and regress in this nation. And so if we think about post-Civil War Reconstruction and the great progress that we made, and we had elected officials, Black elected officials, even in the South, and then that was a very short-lived experiment. And we had decades of brutality and Jim Crow, military, Black military officers being lynched in their uniforms, redlining, the refusal to include Black women in many of the New Deal policies, therefore the lack of generational wealth that was able to be passed down because of Black domestic workers, you know, people being fired. You know, we always joke, Good Times, the TV show, the Norman Lear TV show with John Amos, you know, his famous tagline is, you know, Florida was last hired and first fired. These are all things that Black Americans are fully aware of. Nothing that's happening right now is a shock. It's just a shock to so many white people because it's never happened to them. But what we're seeing, sadly, happen in the 21st century, so many of our parents and grandparents have told us these stories. My parents, who were very young and hip and we traveled together, they went to segregated schools. My father integrated his high school in Miami. My mother never went to integrated schools a day in her life. You know, and these are people who are still walking among us. Ruby Bridges isn't even 70 years old. So many people have no idea who Ruby Bridges even is, right? The little Black girl who integrated Louisiana public schools. And there's been a systemic erasure of Black history consistently, book bannings consistently. So as I write in the piece, you know, we kind of jump from slavery and Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass to all of a sudden civil rights. We jump over 100 years to Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. And then all of a sudden we jump a few more decades to a post-racial Barack Obama. But there's a really, really brutal and bloody and dark history of Black people in this country at the hands of white people, not all white people, but at the hands of enough white people to push us into a really hard conversation that we've refused to have as a nation. And because of that, so many people are hand-wringing and head-scratching at this particular moment.
And Professor Greer, I wanted to ask you about the Trump administration's not only attacks on higher education over issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, but now that the U.S. Department of Education is requiring all public school systems within a few days to certify that they've done away with what the administration calls discriminatory diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Your response?
How is it discriminatory to know one's history? I mean, we can't move forward as a nation collectively, and that's what all of my books are about, really trying to figure out how do we move forward if we don't understand our collective past. You know, white people and Black people are inextricably linked in this country, not just our last names and our families, but the brutality that, you know, so many people experienced on this land. It's our shared history. Black history is American history, and to not understand it is to not fully understand this country. It's to not understand why LBJ was such a great president and helped push forward the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Immigration Act, and the complexities of how he did that as a white Southerner. To not understand this country is to not understand Eisenhower, you know, integrating the armed forces by executive order, and how we've used executive orders in the past for some really amazing things, the Emancipation Proclamation, integrating the armed forces, and for some really horrific things, i.e. Japanese internment camps that put in Italians and Germans as well. So to not understand our shared history is to sort of meet the moment and not know where we're going. And I think that's part of the frustration that so many Americans have right now. I think that's part of the confusion that is deliberate right now. We have to have, you know, children can understand complex issues. I think anyone who's been around kids long enough, if you present them with information in a way that is palatable, they get it. And it's not divisive to understand how there was U.S. chattel slavery in this country. It's not divisive to understand how we once had thousands of different Native American tribes across the nation. You know, I live in New York State. We had a robust Native American community that is no longer in many parts of the state. And so it's our shared collective identity that can help us be a great nation. And, you know, if we want to just get to brass tacks, being a diverse nation helps you make money. That's a language that some people understand, right? When you have diversity, when you have equity, when you have inclusion, it's actually better for your bottom line. So I think Target is finding out how diversity, equity, inclusion is better for their bottom line. I think a lot of businesses will slowly realize, you know, if you don't understand the bus boycotts of Montgomery from the 1950s and 60s, you know, and boycotts in various lunch counters across the South, those were economic boycotts that had obviously other consequences. But, you know, to get racial equity, there was an economic component to so much of what brave Black Americans did in the South. And I think a lot of corporations are going to find out in the 21st century version of what those economic boycotts can look like to move forward a more equitable agenda.
And I wanted to ask you as well about the you mentioned the Trump administration's targeting of especially dissident students and foreign students. For example, you are a Tufts graduate. Your response to a Tufts student, Rumeysa Öztürk, who was sent to Louisiana after being driven to Vermont, but was picked up by immigration agents in Somerville, Massachusetts, the video that captured her arrest and detention, your sense of what is how universities should respond to these direct incursions of the government into their student bodies and on their campuses to seize students.
Well, you know, as a university professor, you know, the university is a space for intellectual ideas and debates. We cannot have a space where it's filled with fear and silence. And so to see that horrific video is frightening. I think universities have to band together. This is what is the point of an endowment if during hard times you're not going to use it? We know that there are some universities that are larger and more powerful than others. If they stick together, collective action, which is what I talk about in all of my books, you can actually get a lot more than sort of being picked off one by one. We do know, I mean, this is, again, time and time in America, if you know your history, you know, as you target one group, many groups don't ever think that they'll be targeted. It's like, your day will come. So if you do not come together and think of a strategy, I mean, as an intellectual space, we debate these ideas. This is what has made this nation actually move forward as one of the leaders in the world, for better or for worse. And so this idea that immigrants take away from the robust intellectual space is patently false, first of all, but it's creating a level of fear where, you know, what is the point of a university if we have homogeneity of thought and silence?
We're going to have to.
It makes no sense.
We're going to have to leave it there. But of course, we'll continue to follow this issue. 8 more international students have had their visas revoked. 150 have been revoked in the last few weeks. Fordham professor Christina Greer will link to your New York Times op-ed, Black Americans Are Not Surprised. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live to help victims and survivors get vital social and emergency services. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call 1-833-900-1010.
Please enjoy 30 Seconds of Nature, brought to you by Ducks Unlimited Canada. Learn how you can experience nature in your community at ducks.ca. Radio.